any activity we conduct is torture, and therefore torture is within the law.
Ah, drat. You know what? I missed the Ubu Hour torture show. Boy.
Don't worry, you can hear it again. Friday, January 20th, 10 a.m.
The Ubu Hour will inflict upon you torture.
On Marlena's Electronic Salon.
And twist back on the head with the snap.
The Ubu Hours, the Torturer's Apprentice. Friday, January 20th, 10 a.m.
We do torture to do our job.
Good morning. This is the KBOO Morning News for Tuesday, January 17th, 2006. I'm Chris Andre.
And I'm Becca Bartleson.
Coming right up, in Oregon, a bicycle activist is suing TriMet. The Bush administration is lashing out at Al Gore for Gore's critique of the administration's illegal domestic spying. And protests against the U.S. continue in Pakistan today. Well, across the border in Afghanistan, a suicide bomber killed 20 people. Portland area weather today, rain with snow in the mountains, highs 45 to 55 tonight, more rain, lows in the 40s.
Randy Albright, a well-known Portland bicycle activist, is suing TriMet over an incident involving a bus in January 2004. After a close call with a bus approaching the Hawthorne Bridge, bicyclist Randy Albright said he wanted to get the attention of the driver. So when the bus stopped for traffic, Albright pulled in front of it so the driver couldn't avoid him. The driver opened the door and allowed a rider to alight from the bus at an unapproved stop on the bridge, assault and batter plaintiff, and then reboard the bus. Albright charges in lawsuit filed recently in Multnomah County Circuit Court. The suit alleges that the bus driver then drove off without calling police or paramedics. What makes Albright's attack even more unusual is that it was captured by TriMet cameras. Within 5 seconds of Albright blocking the bus, cameras capture an unidentified man squeezing past other riders to talk to the driver, who opens the door. The man jumps off and confronts Albright. The man appears to grab Albright's bike, swing at him, and push him back onto the sidewalk. The man reboards the bus, which leaves. Albright said he filed a police report and a complaint against the driver, but his attacker remains unidentified and uncharged. A longtime bicycle commuter who has served on various transportation advisory committees, Albright says he does not normally confront motorists on the road. Albright says he hopes his case shows the need for bicyclists and drivers to work more diligently to coexist on the roads. This from the Oregonian.
The Portland City Council is asking members of Congress to oppose an attempt to shield companies that produce asbestos from full financial liability. Mayor Tom Potter and the City Council colleagues asked Oregon Senators Ron Wyden and Gordon Smith to oppose the Fairness in Asbestos Injury Resolution Act. That measure would shield manufacturers that expose their workers to asbestos from further lawsuits. Senate Majority Leader Bill Frist has promised to bring it up for a vote when Congress returns next month to Washington, D.C. Despite asbestos' potential for causing cancer and other serious illness if inhaled, the fibrous mineral is still a regular component in brake liners, insulation, and tile. Over the past few years, more than 70 U.S. companies have gone into bankruptcy because of asbestos lawsuits. Under the new federal proposal, businesses that may be liable for asbestos-related illnesses will pay into a $140 billion trust fund for victims of asbestos-related illnesses. People who can show that asbestos caused their health problems could apply to the government for financial relief rather than suing asbestos producers. The federal government would oversee this trust fund. This, according to the Oregonian.
In Cornelius, a hearing on a proposed Walmart store centered on traffic concerns, but a request from neighboring Forest Grove took at least one planning commissioner aback. officials want the store along the boundary line between the two cities. Forest Grove officials want a 600-foot-long wall that would block out lights and noise, as well as criminals such as shoplifters. Walmart proposes to build a 204,000-square-foot supercenter on a site abutted by a commercial and residential property in Cornelius, a Washington County city of 10,000. John Holen, Forest Grove Community Development Director, said the police chief thought shoplifters at Walmart might find an easy escape route out of the back and into Forest Grove. But Holen said the concern goes beyond shoplifting. Forest Grove officials hope a wall would also buffer light and noise. That the idea of a wall isn't new. Walmart would build a 6-foot-high concrete block wall along the north property line. The company proposed a similar one along the west side in the original design, but dropped it at Cornelius's request, adding a landscaped pathway instead. It kept a 4-foot-high retaining wall.
A Maverick, Washington Republican lawmaker is pushing a plan to fund police by taxing drug dealers. The illegal drug excise tax is patterned after measures adopted in nearly half the country. It would set up a state system to distribute tax stamps for illegal drugs and alcohol. Dealers busted with drugs or moonshine not bearing the stamps would be assessed the specific tax rates in addition to any criminal fees. That could range from $3.50 per gram of marijuana to $200 for each gram of cocaine. Representative Tom Campbell of Washington, the bill's sponsor, says it's just our little way of saying thank you for bringing some money into the state, even though you do it the wrong way. The more controversial part of Campbell's plan, however, may be how the taxes are spent. Campbell hopes the proceeds can pay for a new statewide detective agency carved from the Washington State Patrol. Patrol officials haven't yet taken a public position on the measure.
Oregon has received its highest grade yet in the battle against invasive species, winning an A- for its efforts in 2005. The State Invasive Species Council issued its annual report card this week on the work to keep undesirable animals and plants from gaining a foothold. The state improved from a B received for 2004 and a B- in 2003. Officials said the better grade for 2005 came after none of the 100 most dangerous invasive species threatening Oregon became established in the state last year. Only one species, feral swine, is thought to be in danger of becoming permanently established. But state officials warn it is continuing battle with new threats to native plants and animals all the time.
Mervyn's is announcing it will close all its stores in Oregon and Washington, 19 total, by February 2007. The company said, exiting the underperforming markets of Oregon and Washington will allow us to make investments that better serve our customers and Mervyn's future. The majority of the affected stores will continue operating through January of 2000, and new merchandise will continue to arrive throughout the 2006 spring, summer, and fall seasons. Stores in Medford and Bellingham, Washington, will close this year by April. Mervyn's will offer severance packages and job placement services to eligible employees affected by the store closures. Mervyn's has 119 locations in 10 states. This from the Salem Statesman Journal.
Clarence Ray Allen, California's oldest death row inmate, was executed just after midnight and just after his 76th birthday. His attorneys claimed that because of his age and numerous health problems, a lethal injection would amount to unconstitutionally cruel and unusual punishment. Allen was sentenced to death in 1982 for hiring a hitman who killed three people at a Fresno market. Allen was imprisoned for another murder at the time he ordered the hit.
Former Vice President Al Gore yesterday called for an independent investigation of President Bush's domestic spying program. Gore is contending the president repeatedly and insistently broke the law by eavesdropping on Americans without court approval. Speaking on Martin Luther King Jr.'s national holiday, Gore was interrupted repeatedly by applause as he called the anti-terrorism program a threat to the very structure of our government. Gore charged that the administration acted without congressional authority and made a direct assault on a special federal court that authorizes requests to eavesdrop on Americans. One judge on the court resigned last month, voicing concerns about the National Security Agency's surveillance of emails and phone calls. A spokeswoman for the Republican National Committee attacked Gore's comments shortly after the address. Gore's speech was sponsored by the American Constitution Society for Law and Policy and the Liberty Coalition, two organizations that have expressed concern about the policy. The former vice president said Attorney General Alberto Gonzalez should name a special counsel to investigate the program, citing the attorney general's obvious conflict of interest as a member of the Bush cabinet, as well as the nation's top law enforcement officer. Gonzalez has agreed to testify publicly at a Senate hearing on the program. He defended the surveillance on cable news talk shows yesterday night.
There's a new challenge today to the Bush administration's domestic eavesdropping program. The American Civil Liberties Union says it's suing the National Security Agency on behalf of a group of people who often communicate with others in the Middle East. They are charging that their communications are being illegally monitored.
New Orleans Mayor Ray Nagin suggested yesterday that Hurricanes Katrina and Rita and other storms were a sign that God is mad at America and at black communities, too, for tearing themselves apart with violence and political infighting. Nagin said, "Surely God is mad at America. He sent us hurricane after hurricane after hurricane, and it's destroyed and put stress on this country." Nagin also promised that New Orleans would be a chocolate city again. Many of the city's black neighborhoods were heavily damaged by Hurricane Katrina. Nagin went on, "It's time for us to come together. It's time for us to rebuild New Orleans, the one that should be a chocolate New Orleans." The mayor said, "This city will be a majority African-American city. It's the way God wants it to be. You can't have New Orleans no other way. It wouldn't be New Orleans." Nagin described an imaginary conversation with Dr. King, the late civil rights leader. He said, "What's going on? What is going to take for us to move on and live your dream and make it a reality?" Nagin added, "I don't think that we need to pay any attention anymore as much about other folks and racists on the other side." He said, "The thing we need to focus on as a community, black folks I'm talking about, is ourselves." Nagin said he also asked King in his hypothetical conversation, "Why is black-on-black crime such an issue? Why do our young men hate each other so much that they look their brother in the face and they'll take a gun and kill him in cold blood?" The reply, Nagin said, was, "We as a people need to fix ourselves first." Nagin also said King would have been dismayed with black leaders who are most of the time tearing each other down publicly for the delight of many.
In New Orleans yesterday, 150 people defied the city's official change from the traditional Martin Luther King Day parade route and marched from the Lower Ninth Ward through the city's poorer downtown neighborhoods. FSRN's Christian Rosalind reports.
We're out here in commemoration of Martin Luther King, but sometimes I think his dream, when he died, the dream died.
Patricia Tate came from Houston to walk down Claiborne Avenue in the city's Lower Ninth Ward on a warm January day with her son, three of her nieces and nephews, and 150 other residents and their supporters, as they had for the last 21 years. Earlier this month, the city had announced a change in the parade route for Martin Luther King Day to tour the less damaged uptown neighborhoods, but a group of organizers, residents, and supporters returned to the corner of Claiborne and Caffin Streets this morning among the shells of destroyed homes. Tate is among those who are angry about what has happened to her neighborhood and her city, and the lack of support she says her neighborhood is receiving from the federal government compared to other parts of the New Orleans metro area, such as the community of Chalmette, which is just outside the Lower Ninth Ward.
You know, that area is thriving. There's people living there. It's a thriving community, whereas Ninth Ward has been completely shut down. And the question is why? And who's going to do anything to make the situation better? And the government, the levy commissioners, the mayor, our governor, who I voted for, all of them have left the people down.
Today's march follows a settlement last Friday between a legal team and the city government agreeing not to bulldoze the remnants of homes without first notifying the residents. The majority of homes in the neighborhood are slated for demolition by the city. Perhaps the greatest challenge facing those trying to rebuild in the Lower Ninth is the lack of electricity, which Entergy Corporation has not said when it will start supplying to the Lower Ninth Ward again. New Orleans City Council Member Cynthia Willard Lewis represents the neighborhood.
without water, without electricity. People cannot return, and on American soil, more than 5 months after a disaster, to have no water and no electricity is unacceptable. And to demand that the full right of everyone to return, essential and critical.
For Free Speech Radio News in New Orleans, this is Christian Roseland.
Susan Collins, Republican of Maine, said the government has not done enough to help large swaths of the Gulf Coast recover and rebuild after the hurricanes. Though lawmakers have approved $67 billion for Gulf Coast emergency relief and long-term recovery programs, and President Bush has called for an additional $1.5 billion to strengthen New Orleans levees, hard-hit areas in Mississippi and Louisiana need more federal resources and attention. The lawmakers also will tour parts of New Orleans, including inspecting progress on rebuilding levees that are crucial to encouraging residents and businesses back to the previously flooded city. Democrats, too, are watching how Congress will pay for what they called continued necessary assistance to the Gulf Coast amid a rising deficit and other high-cost expenses, including the war in Iraq. Last month, Mississippi Governor Haley Barbour chastised Congress for failing to approve emergency funding, thus stalling state transportation, school, and housing projects. The state just last week released a report calling for bold moves to improve its transportation and housing systems to a better level than before Katrina hit. In prepared testimony for a Senate hearing in Gulfport today, the Bush administration's Gulf Coast Rebuilding Czar outlined two top priorities for Mississippi, debris removal and temporary housing for evacuees.
The Republican National Committee has revised their website in the wake of a Ross Story article revealing that the party had listed nonprofit organizations as GOP groups. An article this morning revealed that the party listed nonpartisan, tax-exempt nonprofits as GOP groups. By this afternoon, the RNC had changed their website to list nonprofits and other groups illegally listed as Republican Party groups as other organizations. But Ross Story has found that the Republican National Committee lists a panoply of conservative nonprofits as GOP groups in direct violation of the nonprofit charter. Tax-exempt nonprofits can lobby on political issues but cannot participate directly in campaign activities. The American Civil Liberties Union lobbied Congress to ban torture. Citizens for Responsibility and Ethics in Washington lobbies Congress on congressional corruption. And Americans for Tax Reform presses lawmakers to slash taxes and government spending. Many of these groups are led and founded by avowed Democrats or Republicans. The 501c3 law strictly prohibits groups from endorsing candidates or political parties. A nonprofit may not attempt to influence legislation as a substantial part of its activities, and it may not participate at all in campaign activity for or against political candidates, the IRS law reads. At least six GOP groups listed and linked on the Republican National Committee website are tax-exempt nonprofits. These include the American Enterprise Institute, American Values, Coalition for Urban Renewal, Frontiers of Freedom, the Heritage Foundation, and the Leadership Institute. If defined as a GOP group, these organizations would not qualify for tax-exempt status under their charters. The Republican National Committee could not immediately be reached for comment.
President Bush has rejected criticism over the Guantanamo Bay camp raised by German Chancellor Angela Merkel during talks in Washington. Bush said it was a necessary part of protecting the American people, this according to the BBC. When the two leaders presented a united front over Iran resuming its nuclear program, and commentators said they appeared to have got on well. It is Merkel's first official visit to the U.S. since her election, which Bush joked, much like his own, was not a landslide win. The two leaders discussed a range of subjects, from the Balkans and the Middle East to the Iraq War, which has strained relations between U.S. and Germany in recent years. Before leaving for the U.S., Merkel had said that facilities such as Guantanamo should not exist in the long term.
Democrats yesterday forced a one-week delay on a vote by the Senate Judiciary Committee on Supreme Court nominee Samuel Alito. Alito is still expected to be confirmed by the full Republican-led Senate. The Democratic action ends hopes by Senate Majority Leader Bill Frist to have President Bush's nominee confirmed by the end of this week for a seat on the nation's highest court. Judiciary Committee Chairman Arlen Specter wanted his panel, which held a confirmation hearing on Alito last week, to vote today on whether to urge the full Senate to confirm Alito, a federal appeals judge the past 15 years. But aides to the Pennsylvania Republican announced that Democrats said they would invoke their right to require a one-week delay if the committee met today on Alito. So the committee will vote instead on January 24th, with the Senate begin debating on the nominee by the next day.
The court-martial of a U.S. officer charged with murdering an Iraqi general while he was held in custody began yesterday in Colorado. Chief Warrant Officer Louis Welshoffer denies murdering Major General Abed Hamed Maouche in 2003. Prosecutors say Maouche was bound, placed headfirst in a sleeping bag, and died with an officer sitting on him. It is one of a number of deaths of prisoners in Iraq and Afghanistan that the U.S. military is investigating. The trial is expected to last a week. A lawyer representing another officer in the case said the defense might cite reports that Maouche had been beaten earlier. The Washington Post said the general had been assaulted by CIA-sponsored Iraqi paramilitaries 2 days before his death.
Kaylee Reynolds had a problem when she recently received a summons to serve on a jury. She wasn't old enough to read it. The 2-year-old has quite a few years to go before she reaches the minimum age of 18 to serve on a state jury. Lucky for Kaylee, Massachusetts Jury Commissioner Patricia Reynolds seemed willing to let it slide for a while. Besides her questionable understanding of the concepts of guilt or innocence, there are other reasons why it's best to wait for Kaylee to serve. Her mother, Patricia, says Kaylee gets really cranky if she, like other jurors, doesn't get her noontime nap.
Journalists from CNN have been banned from working in Iran because of a mistranslation of the president's comments. CNN issued a correction after it translated the president as saying Iran had a right to use nuclear weapons rather than nuclear technology. CNN does not have a bureau in Tehran, but gets permits to cover assignments. The U.S.-based news network had carried a live translation of President Mahmoud Ahmadinejad's press conference on Saturday. Its translation quoted the president as saying, "We believe all nations are allowed to have nuclear weapons, and that the West should not deprive us of nuclear weapons." Iran says the Farsi word for technology was translated as weapons. The Iranian Culture Ministry issued a statement yesterday saying, "Taking into account CNN's actions contrary to professional ethics in the past years and their distortion of the president's comments during his press conference on Saturday, no journalists from CNN will be authorized to come to Iran."
The UK, France, and Germany plan to call for an emergency meeting of the UN's nuclear watchdog to discuss Iran. It's a possible first step towards sanctions, according to the BBC. After talks in London yesterday, the European powers said they would ask the International Atomic Energy Agency, IAEA, to meet the first week in February. Key UN members have agreed Iran must stop nuclear research, the UK says. Western countries fear Iran aims to build nuclear weapons. Iran denies it, saying it wants civilian nuclear power. It sparked a crisis last week by breaking international seals on three of its nuclear research facilities. Russian President Vladimir Putin has hinted compromise is still possible. He says Tehran has not rejected an offer for Iran's uranium enrichment to take place in Russia, which would make it harder for Iran to make nuclear weapons. Iran's ambassador to Moscow praised the Russian offer as a constructive way out of the crisis. The U.S., U.K., France, and Germany have been trying to persuade Russia and China to support a hard line on Iran. The six countries held a closed-door meeting in London on Monday. After the meeting, the U.K. Foreign Office said the six had agreed Iran must stop nuclear research immediately. The head of the IAEA, Mohammed El-Bardeh, has said he cannot confirm that Iran's program has a peaceful objective. Western diplomats are thought to believe Russia can be persuaded to back a tough stance against Tehran, despite Russia's large investment in Iran's nuclear industry. But China seems much more reluctant to threaten sanctions. Iran says it will not be intimidated by international pressure and warns the threat of sanctions would result in higher oil prices. Iran is the fourth largest exporter of crude oil. Prices rose in London to nearly $63 a barrel on Monday, with violence in oil exporting Nigeria also seen as a factor. Saudi Foreign Minister Prince Saud al-Fazli said in a BBC interview that the West was partly to blame for the crisis for allowing Israel to develop a nuclear arsenal.
Pakistan's Islamist opposition has vowed more protests against a U.S. airstrike that killed at least 18 civilians, and commentators said the raid would boost support for militants. Intelligence officials said U.S. counterparts had told them the order for Friday's strike was based on information that Al-Qaeda's second-in-command, Ayman al-Zawahiri, was in the area. Two clerics known for harboring Al-Qaeda militants attended but left hours before the raid, and Zawahiri did not show up. Although the U.S. government has not publicly acknowledged any responsibility, intelligence officials in Washington said it was aimed at Zawahiri and said that they believed drone aircraft armed with missiles were used. Other U.S. sources played down suggestions that an examination of human remains or DNA evidence would be used to confirm the identities of the slain. They said confirmation of Zawahiri's fate could more likely emerge over time through word of mouth or a possible recorded message from Al-Qaeda. This according to Reuters.
A suicide bomber on a motorbike killed 20 people and injured at least 30 in the Afghan border town of Spinboldak yesterday, according to The Guardian. It was the deadliest in a recent spate of attacks, officials said. An unidentified man drove near a crowd of about 100 people watching a wrestling match at a fair in the town, a key crossing point into southern Pakistan, and detonated explosives strapped to his body. 20 people were killed, including the bomber, and more than 20 were wounded. It was the third bombing in 2 days in Kandahar province, a former Taliban stronghold, and the bloodiest in a series of about 25 suicide attacks across the country in the past 4 months. Hours before, a bomb hit a convoy of Afghan army trucks carrying troops in the provincial capital of Kandahar. 4 people were killed and 16 wounded, according to The Guardian. Until very recently, suicide bombings have been rare in Afghanistan.
Police in Strasbourg have used tear gas and water cannon to disperse dock workers who marched to the European Parliament in a mass protest. Protesters threw firecrackers, stones, and metal missiles, smashing windows and causing considerable damage. The dockers from across the EU had converged on Strasbourg to protest a controversial proposal to open up port services to greater competition. Elsewhere, strike action disrupted work at major ports from Greece to Sweden. The EU's Port Package 2 proposals will be debated in Strasbourg today, with a vote expected tomorrow. The dockers fear they could lose their jobs if port services are liberalised as the proposals recommend, allowing private contractors or ships' crews to unload freight, for example, or to pilot ships into port. The European Parliament rejected a similar bill 3 years ago, and analysts say members of the European Parliament are expected to do so again this week. Around 6,000 protesters are reported to have joined the march in Strasbourg, although police say only a few hundred turned violent. Ships were allowed into port yesterday, but their cargoes were not being handled. Greek, Danish, Swedish, and Portuguese dockers also went on strike. Dock workers in the UK, Italy, and Poland were at work but sent delegations to the rally. This from the BBC.
This has been the KBOO Morning News for Tuesday, January 17th, 2006. Chris Andre edited the news. KBOO Newsroom volunteers and reporters produced and edited the tape. Kathleen Stevenson is the AM News and Public Affairs Director. Liam Delta is on the board. And I'm Becca Bartleson.
And I'm Chris Andre.
Thanks for listening. We clear the air at 90.7 FM Portland, 100.7 FM Corvallis on translator K264AA, 91.9 FM in Hood River on translator K220HR. Be sure to join us for the KBOO Evening News at 5 p.m. and remember to take a look at the KBOO website. All new, all better. If you have most of your marbles, come and play. The newsroom always needs fresh blood. To volunteer, call Kathleen Stevenson at 503-231-8032, extension 202. Portland area weather today: rain with snow in the mountains, high 45 to 55. More rain tonight, lows in the 40s. Coming up this morning on KBOO. At 7:30, it's Abe and Joe Talk Radio Show with Abe Proctor and Joe Uris, with a focus on community-supported agriculture. At 9 a.m. Between the Covers, the guest is Seth Kantner, author of novel Ordinary Wolves, a story about how a story told by a boy growing up in an igloo in remote Alaska. At 9:30, the guest is Lewis and Clark professor Zahir Wahab. He has made numerous trips to Afghanistan, his native land. He'll discuss current events there and what's not being reported. At 10:30 on Stage and Studio, hear about defunct theaters, Dr. Faustus's Lights the Lights. And at 11 on Democracy Now!, hear Ariel Dorfman of the new Chilean President Michelle Bachelet and independent journalist Reed Lindsay on the latest in Haiti. Have a great morning.
This is the KBOO Community Calendar for Tuesday, January 17th, 2006. Starting tonight in Hillsboro, a new humanities lecture series known as The Spoken Word. This lecture series will feature local and regional poets, artists, historians, scholars, and others to discuss culture, heritage, and history. Spoken Word was developed to present varied topics ranging from the Middle East conflict to literature, history, the theory of poker to politics, open poetry readings to Oregon history, and to teach us about others and at the same time learn more about ourselves. Hosted by Jerry Stutzman, Spoken Word is free and open to the public and is supported in part by the Oregon Council for the Humanities Chautauqua Program, local artists and guest lecturers from Portland State University. All are welcome to come and read or just listen on Tuesday, January 17th, 2006 from 7 to 8:30 p.m. in the main gallery of the Glenn and Viola Walters Cultural Arts Center, located at 527 East Main Street in Hillsboro. For contact information, call Carla Anla at 615-3485. Project Homeless Connect began a year ago in San Francisco, and now thousands of volunteers engage six times per year to help thousands of homeless clients achieve self-sufficiency. The city has seen a dramatic drop in the number of homeless people thanks to the human connections made and the new community focus on finding resources for housing. While Portland and Multnomah County are working together on a 10-year plan to end chronic homelessness, Project Homeless Connect allows you to be a key part of the solution. This is a day to reach out, a day to learn, and a day for new beginnings. Project Homeless Connect will meet January 17, 2006 from 8:30 a.m. to 4 p.m. at the Memorial Coliseum. To sign up to volunteer or to learn more, visit their website at www.handsonportland.org or www.portlandhomelessconnect.com. The Salem Kaiser Chapter of Stand for Children, a statewide child advocacy organization, will be hosting its annual all-chapter meeting tonight. The local chapter of Stand for Children will be celebrating winning $100 million in school funding from the state legislature and electing two school board candidates locally. Stand for Children will also be launching their Vote for Children campaign, which asks adults to use their political voice on behalf of children. The event is free and all are welcome on Tuesday from 6:30 till 8 p.m. at the Mission Mill Museum. The museum is located at 1313 Mill Street Southeast in Salem. For more information or to make child care arrangements, contact Dana Hepper at 503-580-7397. You are listening to KBOO in the Gorge, Corvallis, and the Greater Portland area.